As Crystal said, I am an architect, but I get to work on a lot of historic properties. So I put on my historian hat more and more frequently, and luckily there are plenty of people who have patience with training me to research historic properties. But I'd like to thank the Extreme History Project for asking me to share this story of our state's hospital for the mentally ill. And I'd like to thank the Montana State Architecture and Engineering Department, who hired us in the first place to document the remaining buildings at the property, and to the State Historic Preservation Office, who worked with us on the compliance for our documentation. Finally, I'm also grateful for research assistance. As I mentioned, I can't do it alone. So Chelsea Holling, Angie Kesey, and Stuart Reich were very helpful in helping with researching at Warm Springs. You'll see there's a different title up there because it was actually started as a hot springs and a hotel, similar to Fairmont, along those lines. So I'm assume that part of this story is little known, you know, except for some of us who have lore of family members having been at Warm Springs. And it is 16 miles south of Deer Lodge, just to give you an idea of your location there. If you take I-90 and you keep going west, you'll hit it before you get to Deer Lodge. The current day map here shows I-90 on the east. The red circled area is the current campus, and you'll see so the white are the buildings, and there really aren't that many buildings left. I think we documented 28 buildings, and in its heyday there were 60, 65 buildings, something like that. So it has decreased in size incredibly, primarily because of the difference in function there now. The heyday was in the 1940s. I don't think I mentioned that. But they also had living on site for a lot of the staff, up to about 40% of the staff. And so that's what the yellow rectangular area represents, where they had a fair amount of housing that's since been demolished as well. And this is what it looks like. Like any other state mental institution, it's in a bucolic area. They're really lovely, typically. I worked on one back in Illinois, in Elgin, Illinois. And again, it was in a beautiful, beautiful area. And part of that is so that they can have a farming complex, so they can be self-sustaining. And they're typically kind of isolated, which I think at the time was also a way of putting that section of our society further away from the general population. And so here we're looking at we have the Bitterroots to the west, the Scapegoats to the north, and the Continental Divide to the east. So a wonderful location to be at. And it had a Warm Springs Mound, very similar to the Elephant Mound in size and coloration, if you've been to Elephant Mound over in Mammoth in Yellowstone National Park. This was a site that was sacred to the Indians in the area that, of course, predated the occupancy of the Europeans. This mound is 40 feet tall, about 100 feet in diameter. It was known as the Lodge of the White-Tailed Deer. And this is obviously a sketch of the Indians at the mound. There were multiple tribes that considered this to be of cultural importance, and this was sort of a neutral zone for them. The Shoshone, the Blackfeet, the Penderai, the Salish, and the Kootenai. But it's also a calcite geothermal site that has a lot of hot water coming over, around it, and all through it. And this is what it looks like today. Obviously a different sort of gazebo on top, which was not put up there by the Indians. And this is the second or third gazebo that's been put up there since it became active as a Warm Springs for Europeans. This one is mostly a concrete structure, oddly. But this mound exudes what they consider to be health-giving and renewing waters. And the original intent for placing this institution here at Warm Springs was to make available to patients the curative properties of the mineral waters that flow from the hot springs here. These mineral waters are composed of 21% iron, 9% soda, 8% magnesia, and a trace of arsenic. I know that doesn't add up to 100%, but this is what the records show. And I haven't done the research to see whether this is really a healthy really curative mix, that might be the next step there. But purportedly, there were about 100 springs of various sizes bubbling and boiling near this hot spring, and with nearly as many different colored waters and different temperatures, but all being too warm for use as a beverage. I wouldn't think to drink it myself. But it opened as a hotel in 1871, and the papers were quick to try and advertise it. It was opened by Louis Bellinger, who had, I don't know, five or six different spellings of his name, but he opened with single and with swimming baths, what he called the Great Medicinal Springs of Montana of Import. I like this one. Gilmore and Salisbury's Overland Stage Line. No relation to me. They carried passengers directly to the hotel, the distance from Deer Lodge being 16 miles. And at this time, the population of Montana was only 21,000 people. So he really had to reach out far and wide to get people to come here. He did say that he had comfortable houses, stables, bathrooms, etc., and is prepared in every way to give proper care and comfort to patrons. So he was looking at it in terms of its healing powers at that time, as we all typically go to hot springs for the curative power and the relaxation of water anyway. He tried to get people out by having balls. 4th of July, you see here, and I guess it's not quite Christmas Eve, but he was also providing, you know, supper and called the best in the mountains. He had a band, you can see there, for the 4th of July. So it was really meant to be quite a fun and lively place. But that didn't last too long. He actually tried to sell it as early as 1874. And in 1877, two doctors, you can see these great names here, Mitchell, so that's Dr. Armistead Hugh Mitchell and Dr. Charles F. Musigbrod, they bought Warm Springs and converted it into a place for healing for those with, very specifically, rheumatism, skin disorders, and syphilis, which was considered a private disease. In short, this was to be the best of medical care and treatment of all diseases. And they began with 13 patients. They were awarded a contract for this care, maintenance, and medication for the insane, for the territory. And I will say here that it started out being called an infirmary, and then an insane asylum, because that's what they called it during the day. So you'll hear me refer to that fairly frequently. It wasn't until 1943 that the legislature dictated that the name be changed to the Montana State Hospital. One of the things about the Extreme History Project is that history isn't pretty. And so these are things that we just accept as a matter of course, that this was the name of the property. But these good doctors, I want to tell you a little bit about them, because they did more than just open these the Warm Springs Hospital. Armistead Mitchell, he was born in Louisville, Kentucky, in October 1831. He attended the University of Virginia, and then he did actually go to medical school in Louisville in New York City, and he graduated in 1852. And I won't go into the parameters of what medical school was like at that time, but it's nowhere near as rigorous as the programs these days. And then in 1869, President Grant appointed Mitchell to construct the territorial prison at Deer Lodge, which is why you see the photo of Deer Lodge on the left there. And he served as the prison's physician and surgeon from 1871 to 1882. But in 1877, he teamed with Charles Musigbrod to buy the Warm Springs Hotel and convert it to an infirmary. And Charles, we don't know as much about him, but he had emigrated to Montana in 1850. And then later, in 1895, the two of them established a stamp mill and camp called Mitchell, which later became the town of Garnet. So they really got around in the state, and when they died, there was a lot of people lauding their names because they had done a lot within the state to further it, or within the territory at first. Then they started advertising it as the insane asylum. But I apologize, because this does talk about it being August 1883. There are different years for when we think they actually bought the property. The state's records say 1877, some say 1885, some say 1883, and yet I think we have advertisements for the ball as late as 1884. But they actually, and this is the one thing that's kind of interesting about newspapers, they'll list who was admitted and who was discharged, you know, actual names. These are names that you cannot get from the hospital itself. And there was an interesting article written in the Missoula paper, I think in 2016, about how they really thought it was quite odd that you could get information, private information, from the newspapers. And in that regard, so if there are any names that you know up there, it's not casting aspersion on anyone. We all need some mental health treatment at some time in our life or another. Now, and it was interesting to see what in 1896 what they were admitting people for. The top one is for chronic confusion. At 72 patients. This is 1896. And this is the people going through the institution, not necessarily all there at one time. So during the course of 1896, these were people that came through the institution. 54 for melancholia, 31 for secondary dementia, and 26 for terminal dementia. So this actually prompted Mitchell and Mugersbrod to lobby that the state not establish a separate institution in 1894, which had been under consideration, because they were also emphasizing that look at all the treatment that's needed. There would be substantial construction costs associated that would be incurred to the state if the state started operating their own institution. We also find that we have more people being admitted when we have a greater population. So in 1880, 1890, the Montana population had grown dramatically to more than 132,000, and you do see the population of the patients growing at that time as well. And actually, up until 1891, this institution was still operated as a Warm Springs and a hotel where the public could come. But in 1891, they closed that, and it was only open to patients. In 1896, the majority of the patients were carpenters, laborers, miners, farmers. They were mostly men. They were mostly age 40 to 49. And then the next age was age 30 to 39. We do know that a lot of elderly patients ended up being placed into this hospital, as well as other hospitals around the country. We didn't actually have almshouses in Montana, whereas other states had had them, and that's where a lot of elderly people had been placed. So we had elderly people placed fairly early in the Montana asylum, and a fair number of them died there as well. But I did mention the farming aspect of it, and that's what was kind of left for us to document. And we had a field day looking at this particular barn that was built in 1897, and it's something called a piece sur piece. I can never say that right. But these are essentially cribs of the lower construction of log, where they're actually toe-nailed into the vertical members. So it's not the kind of joinery that you expect to see with most log construction. But this is part of the early farming, part of the site that helped support the hospital. And again, and so in 1910, the state actually passed a constitutional amendment to allow the state to acquire this asylum from, I'm going to call them M&M, just to make that easier. At this time, the state was considering other typical state institutions, as other states had, for the deaf, the dumb, and blind. I know, this is what we called them at Boulder. And tubercular patients in Galen, and other institutions. And so this Warm Springs institution actually became a state institution in 1912, and they hired M&M to run it for them. At the time of the purchase, though, the value of the farming operation constituted 32% of the $571,000 purchase price. So you can imagine that there was an awful lot of farming going on here. And by 1914, just a couple years later, there were 1,236 patients, 365 of which were doing some kind of useful work. And this was considered of great aid to the patients. It was a type of therapy. The photo on the left, I thought was interesting to have it identified as a hog shelter. And as you can see, the aim was to be self-sufficient. And they had a dairy farm, essentially, with a lot of dairy cows. There was a huge dairy barn, cattle. They had poultry. They had gardens. And this accommodated the increase in number of patients. About 75% of the labor came from patients. They built, who also, besides doing farming, built a laundry, built a storeroom, a dining room, and dorms, and a large filtering plant. And the state was always hearing reports, annual reports from the institutions saying that they needed more and more buildings of a variety of types. And they did not always get their funding for that, even with patient labor as a savings device there. Now, this is a 1918 map that, besides being colorful, does give you the lay of the land. We have about, I think it's 1,300 acres at this point, and we have some big blue bodies of water, which is really nice, and that's not atypical for these institutions. They typically got their water for the fire protection systems from bodies of water like this. And the red buildings are brick, because they were trying to prevent fire, obviously, and those red buildings are mostly to house patients. They also had yellow buildings that are of wood frame, and those were typically storage buildings, and then they have yellow with a red outline that was a brick veneer. So it's not dissimilar to the Sanborn maps that you see, but this was our own state's version of it. And on the north are the farming buildings. I'm assuming the prevailing winds would be from the south then, so that you wouldn't get all those smells down at the living areas. And this is a blow-up of that, because it really does help you see that they're feeding water from that funny little circle over there on the left is the mound, and they are that's feeding the duck pond, and there are also walking paths. You know, they're trying to get people out and exercising, and there's an ice house, and there are various support buildings because they were self-sufficient. So this is a picture of the pond, and it's only 5 feet deep. And I think the intent there is to prevent drowning, although, you know, we can always drown in something shallower, but the idea is to have it be of use and to also not be of damage to the patients. They also had a train station, and that was run by the Northern Pacific, and that was there from, I think it was 1912 to 1968. There was a... let's see, we go left to right. The yellow building is a superintendent's house, and the building to the right of that is the general office. The big red building there is the male infirmary, and then that orange block to the right are actually tennis courts. And this is the superintendent's house. This was built in either 1897 or 1902, depending on the records. It actually burned in 1997, soon before they were planning to tear it down. But you can see that that it's lovely with the trees, and the whole idea is to really be a village. This was really a fine community that people were comfortable walking around in. And here's the what they call the general office. And I haven't been able to get... firm records on this, but I did mention that patients were making concrete block, and this building has concrete block at the lower story, and I think that they might have easily been made there on site. And this is the, as it says there, men's infirmary, which is, you know, that big brick building that you saw in red on the plan, and it was built in 1904 as the male receiving hospital. They had alcoholics on the second floor, elderly male patients on the first floor, and the basement was used for central supply and for folding linens. And here's the lovely train station. I think this was primarily for family and for staff to come. And as I said, it closed in 1968 after almost a century of operation. And this was a garage, just to really speak to the, and this is 1918, and actually the powerhouse is to the left of it. This really was a self-sufficient community. The mechanics, some of them were patients and some of them were staff. They were working on cars. They were working on fire trucks. They had their own fire station. Probably, again, both of these were probably built with patient labor. You know, as I said, we do know that they were making concrete block on site. And I don't know if you know much about concrete block, but it was very popular in the 1900s. And we do have concrete block buildings in Bozeman, a few of them. And you can tell because every block is the same. Sometimes they had a couple patterns of the rock face, and so you might see them. But you can tell with the regularity of them. So this gives you an idea of one of the streets. They call this Main Street. And there's the garage on the left that I was, you just saw a photo of in the powerhouse, because they did have to generate their own power and they had their own heat. The superintendent's house there, you'll recognize on the far left. And there's the Warren building on the right. These are pretty sizable dorm buildings for the patients. And as I said, the farm complex was at the north, and I know you can't read this. There's a dairy barn, there's a cow barn, there's a cow shed. In the white circle is the dairy man's house that was built for him in 1912. And there's a photo of it still standing today. It's mostly the farming buildings that have been retained. And this is one where we have concrete block on the first floor. I think this was built in 1912. This is a poultry barn with CMU at the base, and a lot of ventilation. You can see that because you really need that in these barns to keep the air moving. And you can see the various openings at the between the windows there as well. And here's a historic image of that building. It's backwards, but it still gives you the idea that they were documenting what they had there. And you can see that there's a fair amount of, I think, plans for vegetation to the right of that. Unless that's for free running for the chicken, it might be. I bet that's it. And I know it's not a good image, but you can see all the growth, all that vegetation that they're planting there. They were really very self-sufficient, a huge vegetable garden in this foreground. And they harvested a lot of hay. And this was both patients and staff that were harvesting them. So let me give you some of the statistics. By 1925, they had a dairy herd of 200 head, 100 swine, 58 horses, and the hay was for livestock, as well as straw for bedding, which was made on site. They had a high water table, so not all of the 1,300 acres was able to be tilled, but they raised about 40% of the food in the years after World War I. I figured that we should talk about the population. The years are on the bottom, 1877 through 2015. You can see a large spike in 1944, but we also had a lot going on in 1922, where we have 1,312 patients. And you can see the peak and then the decline, which we'll talk about, but it's primarily due to the types of patients, the length of stay, and the type of treatment as well. Now, to bring it back into extreme history realm, the papers also provide information about Gina Kelly, who had a very interesting story that was wrapped into Warm Springs and two other insane asylums at the time. This is 1924, but I wanted to bring her up because the notion of what is insanity, is in the eye of the beholder, right? Well, in this case, it was in the eye of her husband, who really wanted her money. And she had saved $17,500. They lived in Miles City, had been married 20, 30 years, something like that. She was age 50 at this time in 1924. But they had divorced in 1918, and soon after that, he had her committed. And husbands could do that in those days. He had her committed, I think it was in an insane asylum in Minnesota, and he had to pay for that. And just like at Warm Springs and any other state mental health institution, if you weren't a pauper, you did have to pay for your stay there. So he used her big kitty of $17,500 to pay for her stay in Minnesota and then in Wisconsin, and then had her dragged kicking and screaming to Warm Springs. They told her that they were going to bring her to Forsyth. Well, they kept going west and took her to Warm Springs. So she actually tried to sue, and this was a good 7-year process. But she did claim that she was mistreated at Warren Springs, and that's why she talks about the brutal mutilation, which referred to her operation. She was operated on twice at Warren Springs, and they left her health permanently impaired. The operation, one was an appendicitis, and the other was a prolapsed uterus. So those really aren't things that are associated with insanity at all. But one of the doctors said, well, after we did the operation, she didn't seem paranoid anymore. maybe because she was trying to keep them away from her. And this is 1925, where they are talking about, they are supporting the notion that her husband had held her illegally and that he never had a legal guardianship. He really never had claim to her money. He really had no right to even, quote, put her away. But he spent her fortune, and she also had property worth about $7,500. He spent most of that as well. But you can see here it says that the divorced husband of Mrs. Gina Kelly has never been the legal guardian of Mrs. Kelly. The courts also supported her claim that she had never been insane. So she was actually never really committed at any of these three hospitals, and yet they held her and treated her. She luckily only had to spend 4 months in Warm Springs. She was able to convince a judge that she was sane and that she could be released. And the physicians were on, they did put the physicians on stand, and they had to testify as to the nature of the operations. And I think I gave you a bit about that in terms of the two operations they did and how they thought she had an uneventful recovery. But you know, there's always two, don't we know it, two sides to every story. Yeah. But they also thought that at the time, maybe it was something to do with Governor Dixon's run for office again. And I don't know how that came to enter into all this at all. But this poor woman was in the paper on a regular basis. I'm just giving you a small smattering of what she had to go through. She ultimately was able to get back to Miles City and live there. She was finally given money, but it was only $7,700. It was a cash settlement. She actually had been awarded $30,000 at one point, and then that was, you know, the next court reneged on that. And she actually had the Supreme Court of Montana claim her sane three times. She went through an awful lot. I don't know how much she spent on legal fees, but you really have to feel for her. She did, however, rise to the occasion and was able, this is on 1935, posting in the Gazette, she was at parties again, and she had been a piano player, and she had been a teacher, and she apparently had been quite socially active, and I'm hoping that this was a good sign of the rest of her life. I have not been able to find her obituary, so I don't know how much longer she lived, but she was at the Homemakers Club. So that's just a bit of a story of what can happen in the 1920s when you're overstaffed, understaffed, overpatiented, and really didn't have a whole lot of scientific evidence to go by either. And then we get into the, you know, I said 1944 was the peak, and in 1943 the hospital was renamed, hence the renaming of the title here into Montana State Hospital. The population was still pretty high in the 1950s, and the major form of insanity at this time was schizophrenia at 40%, followed by manic depressive and various psychoses at 30%, senility at 10%. More and more patients were age 65 and older. And twice as many patients were from cities than from rural and farm areas. So that good fresh air probably helps our mental health. Of the 1982 patients there in 1951, 1,113 were male and 869 female. And that's not an uncommon ratio of the genders for these. But the medical staff, the adequacy was the lowest compared to select similar states in the region. We could not get enough staff out here that were trained. We did try training. They had really applaudable training systems and programs at the hospital. Let's see, in 1951, a survey noted that, I love this one, and I don't know how I'm going to be able to get down there. A survey noted that it appears that excellent ranch and farm activities were carried on while ironically, it was not possible to provide modern medicine. But they did try, and so they tried hydrotherapy. This was very popular in the 40s. They also, in 1945, the hospital examined their first patient with what they called a psychological exam, and that was the first one in the state. They were focusing on the care of the aged and the chronic. The chronic means you end up spending years and years there. Their common therapies were work rehab until the 60s, hydrotherapy that you see here where you would spend hours and hours in water, be it warm or cold, and then ultimately, and this was for heavily agitated people, ultimately this would calm you down. And also, even though penicillin was discovered in 1928, it was not used for syphilis until 1947. So they had a cold towel system for that. Hard to imagine what good that would do. They also did still have mechanical restraints and seclusion. So there were some patients that were isolated. We also had electric shock therapy and insulin therapy to the body at this time. And they had an epileptic type of therapy where they essentially made you have a seizure, but they found that they ended up breaking a lot of bones that way. And if you've seen anyone in an epileptic seizure, you can imagine that you can break bones. You really don't want to restrain them, and it can be those are very hard on the body. They were trying to shock the brain into being quote normal. And Warm Springs was one of the first institutions to utilize modern chemical therapy, with the result that during the years 1956 and 57, the hospital demonstrated the highest patient recovery rate in the nation. Amazing. And then we get into the 60s. This is in 1959, the new receiving hospital, which provided 140 beds for new treatments, such as the psychotropic treatments that you probably have heard about from the 1960s. And that was a great way to be able to get people in and out of the institution quicker and quicker. So the stays were reduced from years to an average of 6 weeks by 1974. This building was actually built with 20 beds for insulin shock treatment, which they did end up doing less of as they had the psychotropic drugs later. And here's another photo of that building. I haven't been back to the site. I think it might finally have been demolished. They've been trying to demolish this building for at least 10 years because they don't have the need for it any longer. There was also a federal mandate to reduce the number of patients in these centralized communities, in these institutions. They really felt that they should have clinics throughout the counties and throughout the different towns. And so what they ended up doing was removing a lot of people from this institution and spreading them throughout the state so that they could be closer to home and so that they could get daily care go in for, I guess you call it outpatient care, so that they could have that without having to stay in the institution for any great length of time. And just as you might live, you might die. Cemetery. You can kind of see the square of trees around it that define where that cemetery is. And in the middle, it's truncated by a road, and I'll show you that road right here. And you can see some signs on the right and left. Those are date markers. And you'll see they have a section from 1896 to 1899. It's quite overgrown. I was interested to see that the Salesville Cemetery has some similar markings like these little metal markers, which are not very permanent and certainly not marking who's there anymore. There is a guy named Chuck who has a map of the cemetery, and he claims he knows who's where. There are about 2,000 or 3,000 patients in the cemetery here. And now some of them, I'd be interested to talk about the symbolism of these, but some of them are more permanent, and this is where families stepped up. The other ones, we're presuming that they didn't have family to come and bury them, but apparently they did have some money for these headstones. The one in the foreground marks the 1909 death of a private in the Wisconsin Battery, and the log roll to the right marks the death in 1911 of a 60-year-old man. And some of them, albeit simple, are still legible. I'm choosing not to make this too legible for you. We had enough names in the newspapers. But this is a little fancier. You can see that. It's a little more permanent than the little stamped metal. This is more of a cast metal. And apparently, somebody did some visiting. There still are some, you know, plastic flowers at some of the grave sites here. But it's really quite overgrown. But the Warm Springs State Hospital, as they're called now, still focuses on an individualized, customized recovery program to help patients transition back into the community. And the hospital has served the state for over 140 years, remains the only public psychiatric hospital in the state. The criminally insane are housed here, as are those with substance abuse. They currently have about 175 patients, 60 of whom are confined, and most of them are court-ordered. I told you there was a lot of farming around here, and what's happening is that a lot of these, the acreage here, are being returned to a more natural site. And I was fixated with these beautiful horses that the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks maintenance crew has, because they're maintaining about 600 acres of state land around Warm Springs, and they still use the horse barn. And there's still some beautiful birds in the wetlands preserve, which is adjacent to the hospital at this point. So I'll wrap up by saying let's be mindful of the mental health issues that many of us and our beloved ones continue to be faced with, and wish them all the best for a speedy and long recovery. Thank you.